Valcom gets IT right. Whether your business is a startup or an enterprise, the Valcom team has the experience and the tools to make you more effective at what you do. Valcom will be more than just your IT reseller. They'll become an extension of your IT team. Find out more at vlcmtech.com. That's vlcmtech.com. All right, I want to take a moment to thank our presenting partners, the Utah Department of Public Safety, Secuvant, the Utah Department of Technology Services, and the Utah Attorney General's Office. Every week on this program, these terrific partners provide expertise and insight to help business and civic leaders better understand the challenge of cybersecurity and how to keep your organization safe. All right, and welcome to Cyber 24. This is a big week for a couple of cybersecurity-related issues. First of all, November 7th is Election Day for municipal races here in Utah. Coming up later in our show, we're going to talk about the security of elections in our state with Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox. The state constitution designates the Lieutenant Governor as the Chief of Elections, the Chief Election Officer in our state. So we have an interesting conversation with him coming up in just a few minutes. But first, we want to jump into some other news, and a lot of people are eagerly anticipating the release of the new iPhone X. Not the iPhone X, it's the iPhone X coming out later this week on November 3rd. Now, one feature many people have been particularly excited about is the device's facial recognition technology, essentially giving you the ability to unlock your phone, not by using your fingerprint, but just by looking onto the screen, and the camera will recognize your face and open your phone. Evidently, placing your finger on a button to check your fingerprint has become just too daunting of a task for us, and now we can only be bothered to look in the general direction of our phone and have it open up. Well, there is some troubling news brewing with that technology. Wesley Smith is here to help us break down that story. Wes, the allegations from this story in Bloomberg are that Apple has essentially, after touting this device and its security, reduced the accuracy rate they initially were talking about.
Well, that's the allegation, and Apple has responded to that allegation and said that that's not the case, that the security will be the same as what they have already touted.
How good are the error rates on this, or bad, I guess, depending on what you're looking at?
So Apple, as you mentioned in the open, it's about convenience, right? And Apple is big on convenience, and so even the fingerprint is a little less convenient, but certainly putting in a code is much less convenient than looking at a phone.
We used to have to type in four numbers, then we just got to put our finger on it. Now you get to look at it.
I think almost everybody in the security industry would agree that a six-digit PIN is almost impossible to crack. Is it three times that you get before it locks up? Anyway, there's a certain amount of times that your phone locks up, and you just can't crack a six-digit code in that kind of timing. Well, for convenience, we have the fingerprint, right? And that's really easy. But on the new iPhone X, there will be no start button on the front. And so now it's transitioned to facial recognition technology. So with a fingerprint, the error rate is 1 in 50,000. With the facial recognition, the error rate looks to be more like 1 in a million. And so it is, you know, a little bit more secure. But the other thing is this biometric data to use for security. We're in the beginning stages of using that. And this is the very first time that facial recognition will be used broadly by a platform like the iPhone.
And right off the bat, there were some concerns. What if I hold up a photo of the person who I'm trying to have the phone recognize, trying to break into it that way? Can you do this while someone's asleep? What kind of protections have they put in place?
They claim that it is much more rigorous than just a photo. One of the things that they have, an infrared system that Apple calls True Depth, and it projects a grid of 30,000 invisible light dots onto the user's face. So that
wouldn't happen with a photo because it's a flat piece of paper that's not putting off
heat. It gives you a 3D dimensional picture, the unique face print of everybody.
It could even recognize the predator from the movie if it's got infrared.
Right. Well, there you go. Or you don't have to use it in the light. You don't have to. You could be in a dark room and you can look at your phone and it will recognize you.
Thank heavens everyone can still get on their iPhone at the movie theater.
In pitch black, yes.
We're saved.
Well, The other thing that has to happen here is your eyes have to be open. So if your eyes are closed, then it won't open and unlock your phone, which is kind of nice because otherwise, you know, I guess somebody could take your phone while you're sleeping, put it in front of your face and open it. You can't say the same about a fingerprint. If you're asleep, somebody could use your fingerprint. I guess they'd have to touch your finger and run the risk of waking you up. But the facial recognition technology won't work unless you're coherent, unless your eyes are open and you're looking at the actual phone. The photo trick probably won't work. But what if somebody made a 3D image of your face? Not particularly
likely.
But
with 3D printers, could they do it? Probably.
Yeah, so that's the question. Could you 3D print somebody's face? And there are a lot of security experts that are speculating because the phone's not out to test. Yeah, you probably could. You could probably get a 3D printer and you could figure it out. And now keep this in mind too, because this is different than the fingerprint. You can't just look at my fingerprint while we're, you know, having a meeting and be like, oh, okay. I got the code there.
Yeah.
Right? That's impossible. With facial recognition, you can actually go to my Facebook account or my Instagram account or LinkedIn or what my website that shows a profile picture. You can't really hide your face, right? I mean, you go to a meeting and somebody sees your face or, in other words, your password. And so that brings in some unique challenges. You can't hide it. Could it be replicated? I suppose it could. And there are 3D printers where you could probably figure this out. But to go to that expense, and I mean, that's pretty
unlikely. Yeah. If I found Bill Gates' phone, it might be worth going through that to see if you could crack into his Apple Pay.
Yeah.
If Bill Gates uses Apple Pay. I don't know if the Microsoft guy uses Apple Pay. But as an example, Warren Buffett, how's that? It's so unlikely that someone could crack it that even if they had to go through all of these hoops in order to crack it, it's unlikely that it's worth the time and energy to anybody to go crack your phone, Wes, or my phone. Our comfort level with buying things with our phone has increased. I know it's one of my favorite ways to pay for something. Essentially, on these phones, you're going to use your face rather than your thumbprint to authorize a payment.
There are real concerns about your facial recognition now accesses your bank account on your phone. There is a firewall there. You can just use your facial recognition to access whatever portions of your phone that you program it with. So it can just be your password to activate the phone. And then to use the Apple Pay, you have to put in your PIN or you have other security measures. So that's the firewall you can use. But if it turns out that this phone gets sold and a lot of tests go out on the facial recognition, and they find that it's not as secure as Apple has touted, that could have big implications on Apple Pay.
All right, one final question. I have a set of identical twins, and I've wondered since this came out, they're too young to have phones, but if they had these phones with this type of technology, are their phones ever safe from their brother?
Apple will tell you yes, or a lot of the engineers would say...
Or most likely, yes.
Yeah, most likely, yes. We'll say that you're okay. You can use that. There are a lot of folks who are saying that the error rates with a twin especially or somebody who's closely related are much higher than, you know, one in a million. One in a million error rates are based on the entire population, not just on close kin. And so once you have that genetic similarity, then of course your odds of being able to match go higher. One other thing that people should think about, this is actually the most serious implication to me. Once you start putting your biometric data in, it's on the device now. Apple right now has it just on the device, but there's potential for mission creep on this. The point where that goes to the cloud, that becomes really then a different issue, right? You start putting biometric information out there that's stored in somebody else's databases. And if this becomes a bigger deal and people start using your biometric data more frequently, the question for people is, how comfortable are you using biometric data that is stored offsite? And how secure does that become if Equifax was hacked and they were essentially gatekeepers to all your personal data? So if you have your personal data stored in Apple's system and Apple gets hacked, all your biometric data is out. I'm not saying that that is an issue on the iPhone X. I'm just saying that that is a future issue for everybody to consider, is using biometric data that's stored in a cloud or offsite means that your most sensitive information about your personal, your body is out there somewhere.
Of course, we all got very comfortable very quickly with our fingerprints, and now the face thing might just be that next frontier,
right?
And whether or not we'll adjust to it, I would say most likely. Interesting stuff, Wes. Thanks so much. With Election Day coming up just next week, we sit down with Utah's top elections officer, Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox.
We have attempts made on the state infrastructure, hundreds of millions of attempts made every day. There's kind of that general attack always going on. And again, we feel very secure about our elections.
We'll ask the Lieutenant Governor what makes him so sure Utah's elections are secure and talk about the future of voting. That's coming up right after this break. The cyber breach at FedEx cost the company $300,000 because FedEx was not insured for cyber breach losses. Could your business withstand a $300,000 cyber loss? I'm guessing the answer is no. Over 500,000 small to medium-sized businesses will close their doors because of a cyber event. So what should you do to protect your business? Talk to the cyber liability professionals at Hays Companies. At Hays Companies, policy placement is only one step in an overall risk management approach to manage your firm's cyber liability exposure. They design a program specific for you, customized to your business priorities. For more information, contact Dave Whitwer, 801-580-5501. That's 801-580-5501, or visit hayscompanies.com. That's H-A-Y-S companies.com. Okay, so you need to address your organization's cybersecurity challenges, but you aren't quite ready to hire someone full-time. So have you considered outsourcing your cyber risk management? Ide Bailey's Virtual Information Security Officer will partner with you to defend your organization against cyber threats at a fraction of the cost of bringing someone on full-time. A Virtual Information Security Officer from Ide Bailey will work with your business year-round, testing your systems, educating your team, and managing your organization's risk. For more information, go to idebailey.com/virtual. That's idebailey.com/virtual. Take control of your organization's cybersecurity now at idebailey.com/virtual. All right, our guest today is Lieutenant Governor Spencer J. Cox. Lieutenant Governor, thanks for being here.
Thanks, guys. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, it's like getting the old crew back together.
It really is.
Like, these were almost three consecutive offices in the governor's office for a while. It was the Lieutenant Governor, and then there's one, and then it was mine, and then Wes's. So we're – and an elevator shaft in there, too. So it's basically like getting the old crew together.
We're getting the band back together.
That's right.
This is great.
You're the only one here that has any musical talent, so if we're getting the band back together, we've got a bass player and two tambourines. I'll play the triangle.
I did see School of Rock this last weekend, so I can't. That
there you go.
Something.
Okay.
You're
so,
in.
You guys are
I'm
the two
the
most musical.
Yeah,
that's
in.
Right. We're going to talk about cybersecurity as it relates to the upcoming election. And I think a good place to start for all of our listeners would be, why the heck would we talk to the Lieutenant Governor about elections? So tell us a little bit about what your role is with elections in our state.
Well, I was going to ask the same question. why would you talk to the Lieutenant Governor about elections? No, for your listeners out there that may not know, the chief responsibility of the Lieutenant Governor in the state of Utah is elections. We don't have a Secretary of State. The Lieutenant Governor's position subsumes both of those. And so I am technically the chief elections officer for the state, which means I do oversee elections. And it's one of my primary roles. I have an office staff that's dedicated to elections. I used to think that elections just happened, and I can assure you that they do not. It's not. It's a one time a year or two time a year thing for everybody else. For my office, it's 24/7, 365 days a year. We kind of live and breathe elections. And elections have gotten much more complicated. They've been in the news a lot more recently. So it really takes up a big part of the job duties, and that's why we're here.
You mentioned that they're in the news a lot, and this is because in large part the president continues to put them in the news, and there's always rumors floating around or allegations about Russian interference or other foreign interference with elections. For people who don't follow that very closely, and like you say, just show up and vote, or maybe they don't even show up and vote, what would you tell people in our state to reassure them about the integrity of our elections?
First of all, I would tell them that the elections are secure, and you don't just have to take my word for it. You can take others' words for it. We recently met with Homeland Security, and let me back up a little bit and talk about why this
Sure.
is in the news. There were a lot of allegations early on that Russians may have tried to interfere with the elections. Now, I believe those have proven true, that there were attempts to interfere. We have met with Homeland Security. I know the CIA has been involved in some of those discussions as well to see the extent of that attempt at interference. We know that there were hacking attempts made. mandate. In a couple states, those were not successful to our knowledge at all. Certainly here in the state of Utah, we got a clean bill of health in our review. So we feel very good about what's happening here in Utah. There are certain reasons for that.
Were there attempts made here in Utah?
Not directly attempts made on our elections infrastructure. Important to note that recently the federal government actually has now made the designation that elections infrastructure is critical infrastructure.
Right. I saw that.
Yeah, that's a new thing. It's never been part. We have critical infrastructure. Usually we're talking about bridges and power plants and things like that. Now elections is included in that.
We ultimately got around to the fundamentals of our democracy. Critical.
Things that might matter. Yeah. There's a little something there. The question was were there attempts made? We have attempts made on the state infrastructure. Hundreds of millions of attempts made every day. There's kind of that general attack always going on, but not specifically anything that we've seen related directly to election. And again, we feel very secure about our elections. Part of that is that the physical machines are never connected to each other or connected to the internet, so much more difficult to attempt to hack anything there. But there is a second level to this idea that our elections are secure. So you have the Russian piece, but then you had the president also saying that a lot of unregistered people were casting ballots, which is why he didn't win the popular vote. At least that's one of the theories out there. And so that's kind of another level of interest that people have had in elections and something that we're constantly cognizant of and working on to make sure that only registered voters actually get to cast ballot. And those that are registered legally.
When you say the machines, the actual voting machines aren't connected to the internet, you also have a number of backup systems in place to make sure that those votes are counted accurately. There's a paper trail. So just tell us about some of the things that we do to make sure that there's integrity in that.
As I've studied elections, it's fascinating to see people are always worried about the integrity of the elections. And I will say this, there has yet to be an electoral process devised that is completely 100% foolproof. There's bad people out there trying to do bad things in elections. There is always that possibility. So what we're doing is putting into place as many checks and balances as possible to make sure that doesn't happen. So one of those that happened early on, when we got the new electronic machines after Bush v. Gore and hanging chads and all of that discussion, federal government gave all these states millions of dollars to put in these machines, these electronic machines. The discussion was, will there be a paper trail afterwards? How do we trust these machines? How do we know that they're programmed correctly? How do we know that the input is the same as the output? So we decided, this was before me, in fact, it was then Lieutenant Governor Herbert, I believe, at the time, the decision was made that we would print out a paper trail so that we could check those. And we do random audits on the machines after every election. If there's a recount, we always go to the paper trail to make sure that that's accurate. We're also randomly checking machines against the paper trail, and that's important. Some states didn't do that, and now there's a lot of questions and concerns about that moving forward and what they're going to do. And of course, now here we are, 15 years later, I guess, since those machines came into place, and they're all past their useful normal life cycle. Now every state is running up against that, and we just went through an RFP process, and we're getting new elections equipment that will be different. We're actually getting a little bit more away from the electronic systems that we've had in the past and going back towards now a lot of vote by mail. So there are, you have to put those checks in place depending on what type of voting system you're using. We do have concerns about the way the data gets to us and the way we distribute the data to the general public. And what happens is, even though I do oversee elections and that's wonderful and everything, we don't have statewide elections. We don't have nationwide elections. What we have in the United States, different than a lot of countries, we have county elections. Every election is a county election, even a presidential election, even a gubernatorial election. It all happens at the counties, which is good news, bad news. It's really good news from a security standpoint, especially regarding the Russians and what they can do. It would be much easier to hack one database, one federal election. It's a lot harder to hack 2,000 county elections. Here in the state of Utah, we have 29 counties, so I have 29 county clerks. They're in charge of their election, and I oversee that. I help them. I give them whatever they need. I make sure they're doing it the right way. But at the end of the day, they're the ones responsible for making that election happen. The bad news is that it's easy for 29 people to make a mistake and screw up, and we see that all the time, where one county will have an issue. They sent ballots to the wrong people, and so now we have to figure out how we're going to deal with that. So those things do happen on occasion, but we're very careful. Our systems are tied together, and so we rely heavily on the great people of the state of Utah, the Department of Technology here, and what they do with their programmers, making sure that we have the right firewalls in place, making sure only people with access can get access to those systems. They should have access to to those systems. And then again, on election night, things get crazy. The interesting thing about elections is you only get one shot at this, right? There are no do-overs. And you don't get a lot of practice either. Now, we do run some models and we do some practice during the weeks leading up to it where people are uploading data. We make sure the data is right on our end. So we try to game plan this as much as possible. But then it's go time. And at 8 o'clock at night, you know, we close all of the polling places, and that data starts getting tabulated at the county level and then uploaded to us. And again, we have checks in place to make sure we get the correct data against the paper trails and the data that they're uploading. And it gets a little fun on election night.
So there are a lot of counties in America.
Yes.
And they have their own elections on election nights. What do you learn from these other counties outside of Utah? And do you have groups that you talk to, other election officials in other states that you're regularly talking to? Do the feds help distribute best practices? What kind of things, tools in that regard do you have?
We do. And historically, that's been done at the state level. And so we have a couple organizations that Director of Elections, he goes and meets with other directors of elections. I meet with secretaries of state across the country, and we do share best practices. What's interesting is even within the state, like the state of Utah, from county to county, you'll have completely different processes. For example, some counties are all vote by mail now, and others aren't, and that changes the way you run an election. And so we learned a lot. When we started more vote by mail, we spent a lot of time in Washington State, Oregon. They're doing much more vote by mail, and so we learned a lot from them. Again, how to keep vote by mail secure. That had a whole other list of challenges that we worked through, comparing signatures one by one, humans looking at a signature on file versus a signature on a ballot, making sure that those signatures match. So again, we have checks and balances in place there. But we do learn a lot from that. Now, you mentioned the federal government, and we talked about this a little bit, but this is really the first time that the federal government is taking an active role in looking at best practices. They're evaluating equipment vendors and giving us help, helping equipment vendors, first of all, to make sure that they're secure and that they have the right protocols in place. And so this is kind of new territory for us. We had our first meeting with the Department of Homeland Security, and we expect to be continuing to have meetings and having these conversations.
More to come in our conversation with the man who oversees Utah elections, Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox.
You can do all kinds of things online now. Why can't you vote online? And right. People talk about that all the time. They want to be able to vote online. First of all, this is how we give people awesome amounts of power, right? So anytime you are giving people power, there will be an incentive to do bad things and to try to get power without doing it the right way.
Is the future of voting in Utah electronic? The answer coming up right after this break. With today's evolving security threats, it's important to know your security applications are keeping up. You can either wait for a breach to happen, or you can be proactive and run validation tests. At Valcom, they believe in being proactive, and a Fortinet cyber threat assessment is the perfect tool for your security arsenal. This free assessment from Valcom will run a validation test covering your entire network and provide you with an in-depth customized report, all with no interruption to your current infrastructure. Your customized report will provide you valuable insight in three critical areas. First, security and prevention threats, including application vulnerabilities, detected malware and botnets, and at-risk endpoint devices. Second, user productivity, including how social media, instant messaging, and third-party applications are being used. And third, network utilization and performance. So request a free assessment and find your peace of mind with unmatched insight into your current security posture by visiting vlcmtech.com/CTAP. That's vlcmtech.com/CTAP.
You mentioned earlier that there are always problems or concerns with any election system, right? Before we were electronic or we had voting machines, people stuffed ballot boxes, right? Or there was always something to worry about. When you look at the vote by mail, you take out a lot of the electronic issues, but you have other issues pop up. Is there any most secure system to follow?
The answer is no. There really isn't. There are problems with every single model. So take, for example, the way we used to do it. Everybody showed up on election day, and you would go into your polling place, and there would be volunteers there, right? All poll workers, just about all poll workers in counties are volunteers. They get paid a little bit, but you know, there are a lot of stay-at-home moms and people who just are excited and want to give back and help and come out. Most counties are begging for these people to come on election day.
Right.
Unfortunately, voter turnout isn't great in the state of Utah. A lot of dead time during the day. You'll have polling locations where there's nobody there. They have access to the polling books. It would be very easy for a couple people to just say, hey, you know what? We can throw this election. Let's volunteer together. We'll get one of these polling locations where a lot of people don't show up. You can go down the list and just start casting votes for these people, and no one would be the wiser. You know, it could come out later. We could figure it out. But that's what I'm talking about. Even what people think, just the old way, that was the best way. You know, there was no way to hack the system. Stuffing ballot boxes happened. We have lots of Chicago. We always talk about Chicago, dead people voting, right?
Right.
It's happened all over. And so those make it very tough. With Vote by Mail, the hardest part, it's much harder to have kind of the mass voter fraud with Vote by Mail. What you could have is somebody casting grandma's ballot. One of the things we run into is mom casts a ballot for her missionary who's out. Shows up at the house, just fills it out, knows how he would have voted anyway. That's not good. That's breaking the law. You can go to jail for that. We find some of those. Wife signs for her husband, and we give them a call and say, hey, you realize that this is, you broke the law here. Lots of apologies very quickly. And so we have a handful of those every election.
That's actually really good to remember when you're voting this year. It's the individual must cast the ballot. This isn't
vote by proxy.
Right.
Never do that.
Exactly. So I agree that there are a lot of people that say this is such a problem right now. And I wonder, why is it that electronic fraud or cybersecurity makes this more of a problem now than it has been in the past, at least by the perception of it?
Yeah, there's a couple reasons for that. And I think to understand that, you also have to understand kind of the elephant in the room that we haven't talked about, and that is electronic voting. You can do all kinds of things online now. Why can't you vote online? And people talk about that all the time. They want to be able to vote online. So it's something about this that makes it unique. First of all, this is how we give people awesome amounts of power. Right. So anytime you are giving people power, there will be an incentive to do bad things and to try to get power without doing it the right way. So you always have that kind of hanging over this. We also live in an era of conspiracy theories. So it makes it much easier if your guy doesn't get elected or your girl doesn't get elected to blame it on something other than they were a terrible candidate and people didn't want them to be involved there. The other piece of this is what makes it unique is the idea of a secret ballot and the ability to audit and make sure something works. That's where the disconnect. That's what makes elections different than everything else out there. You can, with my bank account, if somebody hacks my bank account, I know what I bought. I have receipts, I have my credit card. I can show you where I was and know that this was fraudulent. I wasn't in the Ukraine buying used computer parts.
And your bank will actually usually catch that before
they will catch it before we even know about it. Here we have this problem where we could do electronic voting, but we would need to be able to audit it, to go back and prove that what we counted, the vote we counted, was the vote that you cast. But once we do that, we've now destroyed the secret ballot. And so the whole fact that this is secret makes it just ripe for this type of a problem. And here's the key to your question and to everything else that goes along with this. In order to cause doubt and chaos in an election, you don't have to hack an election to do that. All you have to do is say that you did. All somebody has to do is claim that we hacked the election. And if we can't prove otherwise, right? If we can't audit it, if we don't have the paper trail, if we can't prove otherwise, then you don't know. You've lost legitimacy. And that's what makes this especially dangerous.
Great point.
It brings up an interesting question then, because the way this splits in my mind anyway is the older the voter, the more likely they are to trust a paper-based system, voting in person or even vote by mail. The younger a voter is, the more likely they probably are to say, why can't I vote online? Could you foresee that if we get, 20 years down the road that the generation that's digital first would say, we trust that things can be done digitally and there are ways to ensure the security of that election far more than they would trust something being paper-based. And especially knowing that most people who actually are active voters are in an older demographic.
Right. And the answer is I hope so. I really do. I mean, there's nobody out there that would like to simplify this and make it more available to people than me. You know, I wish I could vote on my phone, you know, right now.
Early and often.
Early and often. Maybe not the often part, but definitely the early part. We have to solve that security piece. You know, I came into this job thinking, hey, Utah could be the first. We could figure out a way to do this. And the more I studied, the more people I talked to, the cybersecurity experts I talked to, the more I realized that we're just not there yet. Now, I don't want to get too wonky, and I'm not the person to talk about this, but with this new blockchain technology and the way it works with Bitcoin and other applications, there is, I think, the potential to be able to have some sort of cyber audit that can be done following that chain without ever letting someone know exactly how you voted. And it's still a ways out there, but there are people a lot smarter than me that are working on it. And so I really do hope that 20 years from now, people will be able to vote online and with their own devices and in their pockets, and that more people will cast ballots, will have voter turnout, you know, 90%, 95%, instead of some municipalities in a municipal primaries will have voter turnout as low as 8%.
The big question you're going to face is, if people are ultimately voting with their phones, how do you get them stickers?
Well, we're facing that now with vote by mail.
Yeah, people
people demand their stickers, and they're very upset about these stickers. So we're trying to find a way to do that, asking counties to put that in their budgets to actually have stickers, you know, with the ballot as they mail it out. But you know, the people are very demanding, and the people demand stickers.
Maybe the way to solve it is that if you vote online, that your Twitter profile can change to an I voted sticker for 24 hours or something.
That would be big.
It's all about communicating to people that you're part of the activity of the day.
Sure. And a lot of people do that on Facebook. They'll change their Facebook profile.
But I'll tell you what, if they voted.
I know. They could be lying. But here's the thing. You get me an edit button on Twitter, and I will get you your Twitter profile change.
We need an edit button way more than we need 280 characters.
Thank you. An abomination. I know this is off topic, but whoever made the decision to go to 280 characters really should be banished from Twitter and the internet for life.
Absolutely. And if we've learned one thing today, it's that the lieutenant governor has a strong position on Twitter character counts and edit buttons.
And he's feeling the heat on the stickers.
And the
maybe
stickers.
This will be in a future gubernatorial campaign, like a promise.
A sticker in every ballot. Spencer Cox for governor.
I like it. I can see the billboard now.
Look, we have some experience in this political communication.
A little bit.
Yeah. Lieutenant Governor Spencer J. Cox, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, guys.
All right, stick around. When we come back, we're going to speak to a cybersecurity lawyer and dive into some issues you may not be thinking about, but should be thinking about when it comes to legal liability and cybersecurity. That's right after this break. Secuvant is a leading network security company specializing in creative, customized solutions that meet the needs of small and medium-sized businesses. They offer a wide range of services, from managed security and virtual CISO consulting to cyber risk advisory and data breach recovery assistance. No matter what your specific security requirements may be, or what your comfort level with IT is in general, Secuvant will map your cybersecurity program to the business areas that are relevant to you, including brand and reputation, legal liability, intellectual property, business disruption, and so much more. For more information, call 1-855-SECUVANT or visit secuvant.com. That's secuvant.com. All right, it's time to debut a new segment on Cyber 24 called The Legal Brief. From time to time, we'll take a look at legal issues your business may face related to cybersecurity. Today's Legal Brief sponsor, Ray Quinney and Nebaker, a Salt Lake City-based law firm with a robust cybersecurity law practice area. All right, we're joined today by Elena Marigakis. She is a shareholder and director at Ray Quinney and Nebaker. Thanks for taking some time with us.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your career, how you got to Ray Quinney and Nebaker, and more specifically, how you got into being interested in cybersecurity legal matters.
Well, I got to Ray Quinney and Nebaker right out of law school, and this is my 20th anniversary of being a lawyer.
Very
so,
nice.
Yeah, 12,
everybody
20 years
do the
in.
Math, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. Elena
cut
is
that out.
Elena,
cut that out.
Elena is 25.
Yes, exactly.
She got through law school about the
12
time
when she graduated. So I got to Ray Quinney and Nebaker right out of law school and have been a civil litigator and trial lawyer for 20 years. And that's been the bulk of my practice, which has been commercial litigation, business disputes, those types of things. And then a few years ago, got involved in cybersecurity and privacy law as well. So we now have a section of the firm that is cybersecurity and privacy law, of which I'm the co-chair. And we handle all types of cybersecurity events from pre-breach, preparing for things, getting people to have good cybersecurity hygiene, all the way to post-breach and how you implement and improve your processes.
When you started in cybersecurity law, did you have any idea of just how big of a practice area this would become?
I don't think I had an idea of the scope of it, because it really does touch so many different federal and state laws, from the Fair Credit Reporting Act to HIPAA to Gramm-Leach-Bliley. So there are so many state and federal laws. I had really no idea of the scope, which is why I went on and got certified as an certified information privacy professional for the U.S.
We've seen a lot from our discussions on previous episodes of this podcast that we keep referring to cybersecurity as sort of the Wild West. It's somewhat lawless in nature. Maybe lawless is the wrong term to use when we're talking to someone who specializes in the law in this area. But has it changed a lot from the time you started? Has that just the general, not so much the understanding of it, but the way the laws and statutes have changed or formed over that time? Has there been a lot of an evolution there?
I think there's been a good evolution and a positive evolution. And I think that people are beginning to grasp that it doesn't have to be a frightening endeavor to have good cybersecurity organization and to have a good plan in place. So, but I still don't think we're there yet. I think still people view it as being so massive, it's not a task they want to undertake. So we're still working on educating people who don't deal with cybersecurity every day as to the importance of cybersecurity and privacy. That's the flip side of the coin.
It's interesting because you're sort of taking two things that make people who aren't lawyers or aren't coders sort of makes their eyes gloss over, or they prefer just to put their head in the sand and not deal with it, law and cybersecurity. So you're a specialist in two areas where people are like,
trying to avoid you.
Just please don't hurt me. Don't anybody touch me on this.
Right. Well, okay. I agree that there are a lot of folks out there that this is just such a big project that they don't know where to start. So let's start really, really basic for them. Help us identify for business owners, organizational heads out there, help us identify what kind of information they need to identify within their own organization that could be subject to a breach.
You know, oftentimes people think they don't have information that would be attractive to hackers, or don't have any information that might be useful to someone who has malicious intent. But the reality is, start by walking in to your office in the morning and look around. So you likely have a hard drive that has all kinds of information on it. It may have customer information, payment information. If you've got employees, you may have personnel records. You may have health information. And you also may have information that isn't necessarily classified as personally identifiable information, but it's confidential. You wouldn't want the whole world to know about your business plans or your forecasts or your information gathering about your competitors. So if you really start to dig in at that level, you realize that pretty much every entity has some kind of information that would be attractive to a thief.
So what's the Utah statute that governs this? What's it called and what does it govern specifically?
So Utah has a Protection of Personal Information Act that governs every person who does business in the state of Utah. So it's a very broad act, and it defines what a breach of system security is. But the basic requirements are that you have a procedure in place to protect information, and that you have a procedure in place to destroy the information after you're no longer using it. That's paraphrasing it, but in a nutshell, that's what it is.
So give us the information. Like, tell us what the statute would define as personally identifiable information.
So in Utah, the definition of personally identifiable information is first name and last name, or first initial and last name, in combination with social security number, financial account number if it has a security code associated with it, or driver's license number. So that's a fairly narrow definition, and I would encourage people to think much more broadly than that, particularly because this is the Utah statute, and there are 46 other states that have statutes that may define it differently. But that is the way that Utah defines
it. So if you're doing business with an individual that lives in Minnesota, and which law governs? Is it Utah jurisdiction because you're here, or is it Minnesota's jurisdiction?
It's governed by the state of residence of the person who's affected.
Okay.
So if you have customers in other states, which most businesses do, you have to look then at the state in which they're residing to figure out what your obligations are and what your breach notification obligations are if there's a breach.
So tell us what a business's duty of care is for this personal information.
It's to take reasonable steps to protect the confidentiality, integrity, and security of personal information. And again, it depends really on what industry you're in. So you may have heightened obligations if you're in a financial industry. If you're in the healthcare industry, you may have different obligations. But if you just had to sort of say at a very basic level, you have to take reasonable procedures to protect the security, integrity, and confidentiality of personal information.
And those aren't always just set in stone. Those will change every year. As long as Congress is in session, they can change at the federal level. Each state can change them.
So there is some guidance as to what the technical requirements are, and that's helpful for a lot of businesses, but a lot of it's common sense. So don't forget that we still use a lot of hard copy information as well. So when you're talking about information security, you have to look really around your physical surroundings and understand not just do we have the right firewalls in place, but have we locked the door to the room that holds
right.
the servers? Those
right.
types of common sense things, because frankly, it's what people expect.
And, you know, when you bring this up, we can talk about your legal duty, but we can also talk about common sense, right? And so if you have confidential information that isn't governed under the, you know, state statute, you still don't want people to have access to that.
That's
that could
exactly
be
right.
A huge problem.
So if you're in an industry like law, for example, you may not want people to know that you've retained a lawyer. So simply your identity, even if it doesn't have a social security number associated with it, people may want to keep the fact that they've retained divorce counsel under wraps
right.
or counsel for a merger and acquisition. So you have to be very sensitive from a public relations standpoint, because that can be equally destructive to your business.
So tell us what the consequences for losing this information could be. There's state consequences, clearly. There's federal code that might have consequences. And there is also just the natural consequence. Can you give us some ideas on what the risk is?
So in Utah, the Utah Protection of Personal Information Act is enforced by the Utah Attorney General. And the fines can be no greater than $2,500 for a violation.
Is that per individual?
That's per violation, no greater than $100,000 in the aggregate. So that's on the Utah side.
Right.
But again, there are also federal statutes. So if you're under HIPAA's jurisdiction, you potentially face fines for information being disclosed in an unauthorized manner. So
okay.
you may have federal fines. And then there are threats like being audited, for example, by the Office of Civil Rights. You could be subject to an audit for 20 years. That's even more devastating than having to pay a one-time fine.
Yeah, that sounds brutal.
You also face potential civil lawsuits as well. And also, put as an aside, if you have contracts, private contracts with vendors, there may be fines associated with your failure to maintain the confidentiality of that information.
Those people who go off the grid and live in the forest are starting to sound smarter and smarter yeah. every week we do this show.
it's amazing all the risk that's out there. So the civil suits that you mentioned, we've seen some of that with Equifax, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people that'll come forward and tell us about how those civil suits are changing a little bit right now.
So right now, what we've seen a lot of is class action suits, but people are starting to become much more creative because even if there isn't a private right of action, like even if you can't bring a civil suit against someone for violating a state or federal statute, sometimes people are bringing negligence causes of action, okay? So if you are a board member of an organization and you have not focused in on cybersecurity, you could be sued for a breach of your fiduciary duties or for negligence. And those are very real possibilities and also very lucrative for a plaintiff who has been the victim of a breach. So people are becoming much more creative, and I think we will begin to see more civil lawsuits as we work our way through what it takes to be able to bring those lawsuits.
So this gets us into another interesting risk that's out there that has nothing to do with the actual – well, it does have something to do with the lawsuit, but not directly. There's a PR element to this.
There's a huge PR element. And that's why when you encounter a breach, it's very important to have your entire breach team in order ahead of time. Because the time to be figuring out who your PR person is or who your contact person is or who your spokesperson is not in the middle of the breach. In fact, what's more damaging than any kind of fines is sometimes the loss of customer loyalty or the public relations hit that comes with the fact that you really didn't have any plan as to what you were going to do if there was a breach.
So step one is to consider the plan in the first instance, to just walk us through what we should be thinking as a business to wrap our arms around this.
So to approach this in an organized and manageable way, I think step one would be to contact legal counsel to create an information security plan. And you can think about that in terms of what we saw 20 or 30 years ago as the employee manual. This is sort of the cybersecurity employee manual of this generation. So creating an information security plan, which is comprehensive, which talks about what your assets are, how you protect those assets, how you back those assets up, and also what your policies and procedures are. Who can access the information? Under what circumstances? What do we do when someone leaves the organization? All of those types of policies and procedures need to be in place. And part of that information security plan is also an incident response plan as well.
And you can help walk folks through this.
This is something we do at Ray Quinney and Nebaker all the time, is to do information security plans to help people organize this vast, vast world of cybersecurity and help them approach it in a step-by-step organized manner so it doesn't seem insurmountable.
Elena Maragakis, shareholder and director at Ray Quinney and Ebaker. Thanks so much for your time. All right, before we go, we want to remind you to visit our website at cyber24.us. That's cyber, the number two, the number four, .us. That's where you can find more episodes of this podcast as well as some helpful information. We also hope you'll follow us on Twitter at cyber24_. That's our handle. You can follow us on Facebook as well. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher. And if you listen in on iTunes, please leave us a review. That helps quite a bit. We want to thank our guests today, Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox and Elena Maragakis from Ray Quinney and Nebaker. And of course, we want to thank our sponsors, Hays Companies, Valcom, and Ide Bailey. Please support them the way they support our podcast. Of course, we always want to thank our presenting partners, the Utah Department of Public Safety, the Utah Department of Technology Services, the Utah Attorney General's Office, and Secumont. We recorded today's episode at the University of Utah's Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute. We also want to thank our distribution partners at utahpolicy.com for helping spread the word. Thanks so much for listening, everybody.